The black cause was not just about Wilson. It was also about the two political parties. Even though Republicans were the party of emancipation and civil rights, they were also the party of individualism and self-reliance. Du Bois didn't believe in self-reliance. He believed in reliance upon the centralized state. And he detected a subtle but unmistakable movement in the Democratic Party from the party of states' rights to the party of centralized state power. Du Bois realized that the Democrats under Wilson were creating a new plantation to be run by a new elite progressive class that would replace the old planter class. Du Bois was not entirely against such an arrangement. Indeed, he had argued that the black community should be led by a talented tenth of its smartest men. One might reasonably suspect that Du Bois envisioned himself at the helm of this group. Yet this was not Wilson's idea at all. His progressive plantation had no room for blacks at the top, and consequently Du Bois grew disenchanted with Wilson. Du Bois's disenchantment with Wilson is today shared by most progressives. Wilson's racist progressivism is an embarrassment to their current political strategy. But progressives still revere Du Bois. So they ignore Du Bois's role in putting Wilson in the White House, pretending that it never happened. But in fact, Du Bois didn't just give Wilson his personal endorsement, he also drew other influential blacks, including Boston activist William Monroe Trotter, to the Democratic Party, helping Wilson and the Democrats win a very close election. This is part of a bigger story that tells us as much about progressives as it does about Du Bois. They continue to lionize Du Bois because they, too, are aficionados of centralized state power. They, too, as Du Bois did, envision a role for black progressives as overseers on their new plantation. They, too, as we will see, were complicit in the great schemes of 20th century tyranny, not merely Stalinism, but also Nazism. Thus, for the Democrats and the progressives who led them, the tyranny of the old slave plantation was replaced by the tyranny of the state. The state, in fact, became the new plantation, run not by an elite class of Democratic planters, but by a single Democratic big boss, initially Wilson, and later Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama, operating from a big house that we know as the White House. Wilson began this reinvention of the Democratic plantation from a rural network specializing in black exploitation to a national network of ethnic exploitation involving multiple minority groups. But Wilson could only take the new progressive plantation so far. It took FDR to actually build it, and other Democratic presidents to give it its current shape and form. In this and the following two chapters, we see how the progressive Democrats creatively reinvented the plantation. They did this by deploying new weapons, white supremacy, and ethnic mobilization that had existed under slavery, but were developed by progressives into a comprehensive system of exploitation. At the same time, we should be cognizant that a subsequent generation of progressives has rewritten history to pin the blame for ethnic mobilization and white supremacy onto their adversaries, the very party that fought against Democrats' vicious and bigoted schemes from the outset. Why Wilson admired Lincoln. Here we move from the progressive intellectual Du Bois to the progressive president, Wilson. Wilson, FDR, and LBJ are acknowledged to be the three leading progressives of the 20th century. Consequently, they are all celebrated in the historiography of the left. In a recent article, The Do-Gooder, The New Republic ranks Wilson among America's greatest presidents. Wilson is praised by progressive biographers for his supposed dedication to global self-determination and for his progressive reforms, including the introduction of the income tax, the Federal Reserve, and greater federal regulation of industry. But Wilson's blatant record of racism is too much for today's progressives to ignore. I find it comical how Democrats today are in the awkward position of having to repudiate the embarrassing bigotry of virtually all their early presidents from Jackson through Wilson. In fact, it is crucial for their narrative to distance themselves from the deep racism not only in the Democratic Party's history, but also in early progressive history. So progressive activists assail Wilson, always careful to identify him as a Southerner rather than a Democrat, and demand that the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton change its name, while of course keeping its progressive intellectual thrust. But if Wilson was a progressive racist, shouldn't Princeton get rid of the progressivism and not just Wilson's contaminated name? No one on the left is pressing for this because no one on the left admits that progressivism has anything to do with racism. Wilson's biographers like Arthur Link and John Milton Cooper insist his racism was a regrettable leftover from his Southern roots. So Wilson did these wonderful progressive things, but occasionally we hear his Southern background reasserted itself, and he did some bad stuff like show the Ku Klux Klan propaganda movie in the White House and segregate the federal government and so forth. Yes, even the progressive critique of Wilson is part of the big lie to blame the South for the bigotry of progressivism and of the Democratic Party. Wilson regarded himself as having transcended Southern provincialism. Having absconded from Princeton at a young age, he believed he embodied the most enlightened progressivism of the early 20th century, a progressivism far more associated with the North than the South. That Wilson was in no way representative of democratic thinking in the South can be seen in a single fact: his almost over-the-top admiration for Abraham Lincoln. This is a surprise. America's first progressive Democratic president modeled himself upon America's first Republican president? Our initial bafflement and incomprehension, however, gives way to understanding when we see what it was that Wilson admired about Lincoln. Wilson did not admire Lincoln for his Republican dedication to the principles of the American founding. On the contrary, Wilson was the first American president to denounce the founders. Wilson ridiculed the founding system of separation of powers and checks and balances. Wilson did not share the founders' belief that an all-powerful centralized state poses a grave threat to the rights and freedom both of individuals and of states. Wilson rejected the founding scheme of distributing power between the federal government and the states, and also among the various branches of the federal government to minimize abuses of power. What Wilson admired most about Lincoln was his willingness to greatly increase the power of the federal government at the expense of the states. Lincoln had simply refused to let states secede, a marvelous display of federal control over renegade subdivisions that wanted to go their own way. Wilson also admired Lincoln's willingness to undercut the constitutional system of checks and balances when the situation warranted. Lincoln, for example, suspended habeas corpus, even though the Constitution clearly gives that power to Congress. Lincoln also earned Wilson's praise for his readiness to revoke civil liberties, as when he had Ohio Copperhead Clement Vallandigham arrested for incendiary speeches opposing the war. Yes, Vallandigham was a Democrat, and Wilson sympathized with him in that regard, but in the broader sense, Wilson admired how Lincoln handled the Vallandigham case, because he saw in Lincoln a man who represented unlimited state power concentrated in the executive branch, a Republican model for Wilson's own Democratic administration. How would Lincoln, had he lived to see them, have responded to Wilson's commendations? I believe he would have been deeply offended by them. Let's begin with Lincoln's use of federal power to prevent states from withdrawing from the Union. Lincoln's point was that the sole reason for seceding was the Southern Democrats' refusal to accept the result of a free election. What was the point of having elections if the losers could then invalidate them by escaping the governance of an electoral majority? Lincoln viewed the concentration of federal power that occurred during his administration as a military strategy necessary to put down an armed rebellion and win a civil war. He perceived the measures he took on habeas corpus, on suspending civil liberty, even the Emancipation Proclamation, as acts taken under duress. He considered none of these measures the normal conduct of government, and with the exception of the Emancipation Proclamation, he intended none to outlast the war. Consider Lincoln's argument for suspending habeas corpus. Yes, this power was given to Congress by the Constitution, but the very existence of an armed assault on the government prevented Congress from being able to meet and act promptly. Therefore, Lincoln insisted his executive branch had the temporary authority to act on behalf of Congress, and this action was legitimate, provided Congress, upon considering it, approved the measure, which it did. Lincoln did not himself call for the arrest of Vallandigham, although he approved the move when one of his generals, Ambrose Burnside, ordered it. Lincoln's reasoning was that Vallandigham had gone beyond criticizing war policy to actively encouraging anti-draft riots and exhorting soldiers to leave the front, and this posed a danger to war recruitment and military rules. "Must I shoot a simple soldier boy who deserts?" Lincoln asked, "while I must not touch a hair of the wily agitator who induces him to desert?" Yet Lincoln was fully aware of how Democrats used the Vallandigham case to portray him as a tyrant. He did not wish to give fodder to such accusations, so shortly after Vallandigham's arrest, Lincoln ordered him released and turned over to the Confederacy. Lincoln's commitment to the Founders' scheme can probably be seen most vividly in his insistence that the 1864 election go ahead, even though it took place in the desperate and decisive stage of the war. Lincoln could have argued for postponing the election until the war was over, but such a thought seems not even to have entered his mind. Moreover, for several months while the conflict dragged on, Lincoln himself believed it possible, even probable, that he would lose the election. For a time, it was not even clear he would be the Republican nominee. Ultimately, the victories of the Union armies led by Grant and Sherman revived Lincoln's popular support and ensured his re-election. Even so, his willingness to risk defeat, to risk what in his mind represented the continuation of the plantation, this time in the North as well as in the South, confirms his determination to respect the founding formula of government by popular consent, even under conditions of extreme duress. In sum, Lincoln was an American nationalist, while Wilson was a statist. What Lincoln considered to be extraordinary powers, used by government only in the event of a national emergency, Wilson saw as powers to be used in the ordinary course of government. Essentially, Wilson turned what was provisional and most problematic about Lincoln, and recognized as such by Lincoln himself, into a new progressive creed alien to the spirit of Lincoln and also to the spirit of the American founding. Why, we may ask, was Wilson himself and the whole progressive democratic movement that grew around him so enamored of the power of centralized government? The usual progressive answer is that progressives came to realize that they were the smartest people and that society runs most efficiently with the smartest people at the helm. This is the theme of progressive manifestos like Herbert Croly's Progressive Democracy and E.A. Ross's Social Control, in which Croly and Ross argue that societies don't run themselves. Someone has to control them, and it may as well be highly educated and highly specialized social scientists like themselves. "The state is an organization that puts the wise minority in the saddle," Ross writes. "The state aims more steadily at a rational safeguarding of the collective welfare than any organ society has yet employed. While in theory, the state is supposed to be democratically chosen by the society," Ross argues that, "as a matter of fact, the state, when it becomes paternal and develops on the administrative side, is able in a measure to guide the society it professes to obey. It becomes, in a sense, an independent center of social power." Here we see how progressive intellectuals sought, with a certain measure of rat-like cunning, to subvert the democratic process. Their goal was the administrative state that, while being installed by the people, would govern for rather than by the people. The true rulers would be the progressives themselves, guided by the mind of the progressive intellectual. And this progressive longing is with us today. It explains why so many in academia and the professional sectors count themselves as progressives. They aspire to join the ruling class that administers the centralized state. Many Republicans and conservatives don't seem to get this. The conservative response, influenced by writers like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, is to make the case for why centralized societies don't work. Conservatives argue in the Hayekian mode that societies are organisms that are far too complex for even the most intelligent and dedicated administrators to run from central command. This response, however, misses the thrust of what is so appealing to progressives about the centralized state and why progressives don't really care whether the centralized state makes the best or most efficient decisions compared to alternative ways of organizing society. Look at the problem this way. Imagine going to a plantation owner and giving him the macroeconomic argument that he shouldn't use a forced labor system because slavery is a very inefficient way of organizing society. After all, slaves being unpaid have little motivation to work and blah, blah, blah. Some Republicans and abolitionists did at the time make this sort of case to planters. Not surprisingly, they made very few converts. What would a plantation man say to someone who talked like this? Most likely he would respond with a scornful laugh. If pressed, he would say he doesn't give a damn about the profit to society. What motivates his enterprise is its profit to him. Sure, the slaves are reluctant to work, but that problem has had a workable solution ever since the invention of the whip. From the planter's point of view, unpaid labor is obviously the best form of labor because it costs close to nothing and the planter keeps the vast share of the profit. Back to Woodrow Wilson and the early generation of progressive Democrats. What motivated their enthusiasm for the national government, for the centralized state, was their realization that it was the centralized state that had defeated the old plantation. Consequently, they reasoned that the only way to reestablish the plantation and make it invulnerable was to create a new type of plantation run by the centralized state itself. This way, they could become the new plantation bosses, with power incomparably greater than that exercised by any slave owner. One national plantation, with one big boss and lots of overseers, organized on an ethnic basis like the old plantation, just as effective, a system of exploitation but adapted to new circumstances and therefore structured somewhat differently. This became Wilson's model and indeed the model of the Democratic Party in the 20th century right up to the present. Wilson represented a great shift in the Democratic Party from being the party of states' rights to the party of the strong centralized state. The reason for the shift is obvious. States' rights was the most effective way to protect the old slave plantation. But in the early 20th century, Wilson and the progressives had no slave plantation to protect. They needed a way to revive the plantation, to create a new type of plantation that they could run from a central location. Thus, the Democratic Party switched its allegiance to a strong centralized state because that was the best way to reinvent the plantation. Notice that for the Democratic Party, this represented a change of tactics, but not a change of purpose. Wilson and his progressive cohorts created the embryo for this new type of plantation. Here we focus on its genesis, constructed on the cornerstone of white supremacy. Although white supremacy is the very charge Democrats today make against Republicans, I will show that in its most virulent form, it is an invention of progressivism and the Democratic Party. I will also identify the three distinguishing features of the new Democratic engine of exploitation: racial terrorism, segregation, and forced eugenic sterilization. Some of the surrounding apparatus is now gone, but the progressive plantation itself is in full operation today. Inventing white supremacy. How do you reconstruct a plantation? How do you go about rebuilding not a single plantation, but an entire plantation system that has been wiped out by the Civil War? This was the challenge confronting Wilson and his generation of progressive Democrats. At first, they had to accept what they had lost. They had lost the slaves, who were now free. This represented a financial loss of $4 billion, a number I arrive at by multiplying the number of slaves, 4 million, by the average cost of a slave, $1,000. We can convert $4 billion into today's money and get a much larger number. But let's think about what the loss of the slaves actually represented to the planter class. Historian David Brian Davis points out that in 1860, the total value of the slaves was around 80% of the nation's gross national product. That means that in today's terms, the total loss to the slave owners was not $4 billion, but something closer to $13 trillion. No wonder the Democratic planters went to war, as Jefferson Davis himself said, to protect their very valuable property. The loss of slavery wasn't merely a financial disaster. It changed the rules of an entire culture that had previously been based on status, leisure, and idleness. A Maryland unionist described the new situation facing former Democratic slave owner Tench Tilghman and his family. The younger ladies on Wednesday and Thursday milked the cows while their father, the general, held the umbrella over them to keep off the rain. The general has to harness his own carriage horses and probably black his own boots. Fanny Andrews, the daughter of a Georgia Democratic planter, complained that it seems humiliating to be compelled to bargain and haggle with our own servants about wages. One gets the idea that the true source of her outrage wasn't the bargaining, but rather that the slave owner class, which previously got this labor for free, now had to pay for it. Such was the angst of the postbellum Democratic leisure class. And yet, there was nothing they could do to get their old way of life back. Sure, the Democrats in the South had some consolations. They had replaced slavery with sharecropping. Under the sharecropping system, blacks still worked in the rice, tobacco, cane, and cotton fields. Now they were wage laborers and in theory entitled to a share of the crop, typically one-third if the planter provided the implements, and seed one-half if the sharecroppers provided their own. Moreover, since sharecroppers lived on the plantation, owners found ways to impose charges on them for tools and living expenses that typically left them with little to call their own. Owners also controlled the freedom and to some extent the lives of their workers, who were also their tenants. So dependent were sharecroppers on the employers that some scholars have not hesitated to term sharecropping a form of neo-slavery. Still, sharecroppers were contract laborers. They were not actually slaves. However subjugated they were, they could round up their family and leave the plantation. So if sharecropping was to be part of the new Democratic plantation system, Democrats in the South would have to find ways to force sharecroppers to stay, no matter how onerous the conditions they faced. The great instrument for keeping the slaves on the old plantation, namely the whip, was no longer available to the postbellum planter class. Increasingly, Wilson and his fellow Democrats noticed the competitive threat posed by free blacks in the South. Partly this threat was economic. Slaves who had developed practical skills were now in a position to compete with white laborers for employment. Part of it was cultural. Free blacks could, in theory, intermingle socially with whites and even intermarry with them, while this had been unthinkable for slaves. Moreover, blacks posed a serious political threat to Democratic hegemony, because, overjoyed at being freed by the Republicans, they were now overwhelmingly Republican in their loyalties. The Democrats no longer had slavery to sustain the plantation, but they did have something else. They did have racism. Racism, after all, predated the slave plantation. It continued through the slave period, and it outlasted slavery, becoming in many respects stronger after emancipation than it had been before. Moreover, slavery had been confined to the South, at least in the 19th century, while racism seemed to be a potent force in the North, no less than in the South. These statements require clarification. Racism, specifically the belief in inherent black inferiority, dates back to the first European encounters with Africans in the early modern period. I have written about this in my book, The End of Racism. Basically, Europeans could not account for the primitivism of black Africa entirely in environmental terms, and therefore blamed a good portion of it on inherent and ultimately biological inferiority. This perception of blacks as uncivilized and perhaps incapable of civilization, this original racism, was imported to America when Europeans settled this continent. Slavery fortified racism and fostered an early version of white supremacy. It did so for the reason given by historian C.R. Boxer. One race cannot systematically enslave members of another for centuries without acquiring a conscious or unconscious feeling of racial superiority. The point is that unlike slavery in many other parts of the world, where slaves and slave owners belong to the same race, American slavery was racial slavery. Not all slave owners were white. There were also a few thousand black slave owners in the South between the 1820s and 1860, but all the slaves on the Democratic plantations of the South were black. Boxer's point is that when slave owners are white and the slaves are black, the whites will inevitably presume themselves suited to rule, and the blacks suited to be ruled. The presumed logic goes like this: we are on top, and they are on the bottom, therefore we must deserve to be on top, and they must deserve to be on the bottom, we are naturally superior to them. Here, then, is the original basis of entrenched white supremacy. But it took time for this self-consciousness to develop. That's why we see very few virulent denunciations of blacks, even in the South, during the founding period. Those emerged in the early 19th century as the plantation expanded and a political party arose in the 1820s that reflected the will and interest of the planter class. That's why I say that white supremacy is a creation of the Democratic masterclass. This psychological rationalization for slavery then became corroborated by the wretched condition of the slaves. Even though this wretchedness was imposed by the Democratic slave owner who prevented his slaves from being educated and civilized, the planter would point to the wretchedness of black slaves as proof of their racial inferiority. Yet racism was also tempered by slavery, not only because the plantation system necessitated close and constant interactions between the slaves and the master class, but also because slavery as an institution prevented open economic competition between whites and blacks. Both blacks and whites worked for the benefit of the white master class, and this pleased the masters just fine. As long as the slaves went along with the arrangement, there was no reason for the masters to direct racial hostility to the slaves. After slavery, however, the free blacks became a problem, not merely in the economic sense, but also in the political and cultural sense. Wilson and the progressive Democrats observed what modern scholars have subsequently corroborated. There was more potent racism in America in the late 19th and early 20th centuries than at any time before or since. Anti-black racism, historian George Fredrickson writes, peaked in the period between the end of Reconstruction and the First World War. And in this sea of racism, Democrats thrived. They didn't have slavery, but they did have this. Moreover, slavery was an institution that could be abolished. The slaves could become free. But race, thankfully for the Democrats, was unalterable. Blacks could not stop being black, or as Democratic pro-slavery apologist Thomas Roderick Dew once put it, the Ethiopian cannot change his skin, nor the leopard his spots. The Democrats realized that they could unify the white South by fomenting a shared hatred of blacks. Racism could not offer, as slavery did, the chance to extract free labor from blacks, but it did offer every white person, no matter how poor or ignorant, a chance to belong to an aristocracy of color, placing them above every black person, no matter how successful or educated. Thus, the Democratic formula became one of white supremacy and black suppression. The Democrats would fight to expand the franchise for whites while curtailing it for blacks. They would indulge white hatred by directing it against blacks, especially educated blacks, whose very presence embarrassed racist theories of white supremacy. By cultivating racism, by nourishing it, and by using it, the Democrats realized they could build an enduring foundation for a new type of plantation to replace the one that had been lost. Consider the instrument that sustained the old plantation, the whip. The whip was the tool of force employed by the old Democratic planter class to get the slaves to the plantation, to keep them there, and to make them work. Wilson and his progressive Democrats realized that they needed something similar, a new whip, if you will, a new instrument of force that would take these disorderly, emancipated slaves and beat them back down, then keep them down, and ideally reduce the threat they posed by reducing their actual number in society. At this point in early 1915, who should walk through Wilson's door in the Oval Office but his old college friend Thomas Dixon, author of The Klansman, an historical romance of the Ku Klux Klan. Thomas Dixon's progressive racism. Wilson and Dixon were buddies. They had attended Johns Hopkins University together. Today, progressives call Dixon a right-winger on the basis of his Southern roots and racism. But by now, we can recognize this as part of the big lie. The South was a Democratic stronghold, and racism was virtually the official doctrine of the Democratic Party. Dixon had served in the North Carolina General Assembly as a Democrat. Moreover, Dixon was a self-described progressive associated with the social gospel movement. His slogan was, "Politics is religion in action." In his early career, he had been an avowed socialist. A champion of the homeless, he was also an animal rights activist, known for his opposition to hunting. He railed against capital punishment. Dixon's book, The Root of Evil, contained such a passionate denunciation against capitalism that his progressive biographer, Anthony Slide, remarks, "It almost compensates for the worst excesses of racism to be found elsewhere in Dixon's writings." That's how Wilson knew him, and their friendship was ideological, no less than personal. Legislator, lawyer, preacher, actor, and author, Dixon also claimed to be an expert on Reconstruction, who had mastered, in his own words, 4,000 volumes of American historical records. In 1902, he published the bestseller The Leopard Spots, a romance of the white man's burden, and followed it up with The Klansman, a lurid account of a Northern Republican who colludes with vicious, lustful blacks to persecute the South and violate its lovely maidens. The villain of The Klansman is a character named Austin Stoneman, explicitly modeled on the Pennsylvania Republican abolitionist Wendell Phillips. The victims are ordinary put-upon Southern Democrats who are just trying to get on with their lives when they are set upon by this predatory alliance of Republicans and Negroes. And the heroes of the book are the Knight Riders of the Ku Klux Klan, who swoop down gallantly and overthrow the bad Republicans and Negroes, reestablishing a reign of virtue in the South. Here's a sample passage by Dixon. "At night, the hoofbeat of squadrons of pale horsemen and the crack of their revolvers struck terror into the heart of every Negro, carpetbagger, and scalawag." No wonder Dixon dedicated his book to the memory of a Scotch-Irish leader of the South, my uncle, Colonel Leroy McAtee, Grand Titan of the Ku Klux Klan. The Klansman was another publishing success, and Dixon even wrote a stage play based on it. But now, he told Wilson, the acclaimed Hollywood producer D.W. Griffith had turned the story into a powerful movie, Birth of a Nation. Dixon was right about this. The film is even today acknowledged to be a technical masterpiece, using the latest cinematic techniques to convert Dixon's literary melodrama into arresting scenes that build inexorably toward an explosive climax. Dixon wanted Wilson to screen the movie in the White House and invite his cabinet and other influential figures. Progressive historical accounts of this meeting typically depict Wilson as the gullible fellow who went along with Dixon and Griffith's nefarious scheme. But Wilson was obviously too intelligent not to recognize the publicity that a screening would provide the new movie. It would be the first ever film shown at the White House. I believe Wilson knew exactly what he was doing. Dixon promised that the film would transform every man in my audience into a good Democrat. And this was exactly what Wilson had in mind. What Wilson may not have realized, I suspect he did realize it, but he may not have, is that the White House screening of Birth of a Nation would help inspire a Klan rejuvenation. If Wilson didn't know it immediately, he surely knew it soon. That's because when the film opened in theaters, the nearby streets in several cities were filled with whites on horseback, wearing full Ku Klux Klan regalia. More than 3 million people saw it in its first year. Many of them undoubtedly constituted the original membership of a revived Ku Klux Klan. Wilson's comment on seeing the film, according to Griffith, was simply, "It is like writing history with lightning," and that the events portrayed in the film were all true. Wilson's progressive biographers attempt to distance Wilson from this quotation, since it does not appear in official records, yet there is no reason to believe Griffith made it up. Moreover, Birth of a Nation itself is laced with on-screen quotations taken directly from Wilson's writings and leave little doubt that his views were congruent with those expressed in the film. The Klan revival that Wilson inspired was a national phenomenon that went beyond the reach of the original Ku Klux Klan. It's not widely known, in part because progressive textbooks don't mention it, that the original Ku Klux Klan was a largely regional phenomenon concentrated in 9 southern states. But Wilson helped inspire a second Ku Klux Klan that stretched from Maine to the Midwest to California. The new Klan had more members outside the South than within it. This was a Klan no less murderously terrorist than its earlier predecessor, but one that now stretched from sea to shining sea. Once more, the Ku Klux Klan became the domestic terrorist arm of the Democratic Party, just as it had been in the 19th century. Again, whether Wilson foresaw this or not, this was what actually happened. And the Klan became just what Wilson and his progressive Democrats were searching for, an institutional whip used to beat blacks down and keep them from competing with whites for jobs, socializing with whites, or, most important of all, voting Republican. In her book, White Rage, Carol Anderson describes the typical Klan murder. One of the most macabre formats was a spectacle lynching, which advertised the killing of a black person and provided special promotional trains to bring the audience, including women and children, to the slaughter. These gruesome events were standard family entertainment, severed body parts became souvenirs, and decorations hung proudly in homes. As Anderson recognizes, the new Klan was different from its predecessor in some respects. The old Klansmen wore stilts under their robes to appear 9 feet tall. The new Klan was distinguished by the white sheets and pointed hats. The old Klan didn't burn crosses. The new Klan got that idea from a climactic scene in Griffith's movie. The old Klan targeted blacks and white Republicans. The new Klan targeted blacks and also Catholics and Jews. But murder for entertainment and political gain was a common feature of the old Klan and the new. And the one little detail Anderson leaves out is that these were murders typically organized in league with the local Democratic Party, with Democratic crowds in attendance, and conducted in large part to send a message to black Republican voters. The Klan reached its zenith in the mid-1920s. When membership in the organization stood between 3 and 5 million. During this period, the Klan controlled Democratic primaries in many states. At the 1924 Democratic National Convention, informally known as the Klan Bake, Klansmen defeated a motion even to condemn KKK violence. After this, enrollment in the Klan declined, but not before it largely achieved its goal of suppressing blacks, and in particular the black vote, thus keeping the Southern vote solidly white and solidly Democratic through the first half of the 20th century. And what happened to Thomas Dixon? Progressive accounts typically leave their discussion of him around 1915, the date Birth of a Nation was released. Dixon, however, went on to a prominent career as a writer and Democratic Party activist. He was a zealous campaigner for FDR in 1932, gave numerous speeches championing FDR's National Recovery Act, the signature program of the New Deal, and was rewarded by the FDR administration with an appointment as clerk of the United States Court, Eastern District of North Carolina. Although Dixon later soured on the New Deal, he retained his judicial position from 1938 to 1946, the year of his death. Man in a Cage. Now that Wilson and the progressive Democrats had found a way to beat blacks down through racial intimidation and murder, they needed a way to keep them down. If racial terrorism suppressed the black vote, something was needed to insulate white Democrats from economic competition with blacks. Here, the Democratic solution was state-sponsored segregation, imposed throughout the South between the 1890s and 1910. Segregation laws required blacks and whites to attend separate schools and use separate sections in buses, trains, theaters, and churches, and even to drink out of separate water fountains in public places. While state-sponsored segregation was a Southern phenomenon, giving some support to the progressive campaign to blame racial evils on the South, it should be noted that every Southern segregation law was passed by a Democratic legislature, signed by a Democratic governor, and enforced by Democratic officials. There are no exceptions to this rule. So segregation was the work of the Democratic Party in that region. Wilson's contribution was to take segregation to the federal government. It's not widely recognized that prior to Wilson, the federal government was not officially segregated. African Americans have successive Republican administrations going back to the Civil War to thank for that. Progressive scholars don't want Republicans to get the credit, so they downplay or leave this fact out of their textbooks. It remains a fact nonetheless. Wilson, however, expanded racial segregation from its local southern precincts to the nation's capital. From the Treasury Department to the post office, whites and blacks were required to eat separately and use separate bathrooms. Somewhat comically, Du Bois in 1913 wrote an open letter to Wilson in which he complained about segregation. Du Bois wrote of one colored clerk who could not actually be segregated on account of the nature of his work has consequently had a cage built around him to separate him from his white companions of many years. Wilson did not respond, but Du Bois must have realized what his endorsement of Wilson and the Democrats had produced. Blacks were now being put into cages. Around the same time, a group of activists associated with Du Bois, most of them backers of Wilson in 1912, met with the president. Monroe Trotter, editor of the Boston Guardian, bitterly challenged Wilson on segregation. Wilson informed him that segregation is not a humiliation but a benefit, and ought to be so regarded by you gentlemen. One may call this the positive good argument for democratic segregation. And with this ended Trotter and Du Bois's hopes of having a central role in administering Wilson's emerging democratic plantation. If racial terrorism and segregation are the first two elements of Wilson's progressive plantation, the third and final one involves what may be termed race conservation. Race conservation has two elements, racially restrictive immigration laws and eugenic sterilization of the supposedly unfit, mostly poor whites and racial minorities. Wilson supported both and saw them as closely connected. Immigration restrictions would keep the racial inferiors from getting into the country, and forced eugenic sterilization could prevent those who were already here from reproducing. The Immigration Act of 1924 was actually signed after Wilson left office, but he and other progressives, most of them Democrats, but also some Republicans, had pushed for such measures for more than two decades. It may seem odd to find Republicans in this connection making common cause with Democrats, but we see that today also. The progressive Republicans were basically half Democrats, just like their counterparts now. Thus, we would not be wrong to dub these early Republican progressives the original rhinos, which is to say, Republicans in name only. The racist rhetoric of progressive rhinos like Madison Grant and Lothrop Stoddard shows that progressivism of all stripes, even Republican progressivism, was imbued with racism. Stoddard and Grant were both close associates of Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger. Stoddard served on the board of her birth control league. Grant was a well-known conservationist, a co-founder of the environmentalist movement, and his racism grew out of that. He believed that just as America conserved its natural resources, it should conserve its valuable racial stock by restricting both immigration and racial intermarriage. To some degree, the zeal of the progressives is not surprising. The early 20th century unleashed a second wave of mass immigration, this time not from Ireland and Germany, but largely from southern and eastern European countries. And with the arrival of these new people, the progressive doctrines of racism and white supremacy took a new and to some degree unexpected turn. Incredibly, the same racist progressives who had previously proclaimed blacks to be inferior now declared that these southern and eastern European whites were also inferior and their number should be minimized. White supremacy now became Nordic supremacy, and progressives distinguished between the superior Nordics and inferior Alpine and Mediterranean types. In order to demonstrate how America was being infested by immigrants, a Carnegie Institution report offered, as its main illustration, the parallel case of the house rat, which traced rodent infestation from Europe to the ability of rats to make their way to America in sailing ships. No doubt fearing economic competition from new workers willing to do the same job for less, unions were at the forefront of the movement to exclude immigrants. The socialist leader Eugene Debs accused the Dago of underbidding union workers by living more like a savage or a wild beast than the hated Chinese immigrant. For progressives in those days, blacks were niggers, Mexicans were wetbacks, Asians were chinks, Italians were wops and dagos, and all these people deserved to be kept out of America or prevented from reproducing. Wilson was fully on board. In his last volume of The History of the American People, published in 1902, Wilson warns that America is faced with the threat of being flooded by men from the lowest class from the south of Italy and men of the meaner sort out of Hungary and Poland. These undesirables, Wilson argues, are part of a great wave of undesirables from southern and eastern European countries that are disburdening themselves of the more sordid and hapless elements of their population. Wilson left little doubt he thought the wave should be stopped, and in 1924 it was. The Immigration Act of that year was explicitly cast in racial terms. It essentially banned immigration to America from South Asia, the Middle East, and the Far East. It severely restricted the immigration of Catholics and Jews from Southern and Eastern Europe by imposing national origins quotas equivalent to 2% of each nationality's population in the United States in 1890. For 50 years, from 1924 through 1965, progressives essentially shut the door on immigration on the basis of white supremacy. Wilson was also a pioneer in the area of progressive eugenic sterilization. In 1911, as governor of New Jersey, he signed into law one of America's first forced sterilization laws. The law created a board of examiners of feeble-minded epileptics and other defectives charged with determining whether prisoners and those residing in poorhouses and other charitable institutions should be coercively sterilized. Through progressive prodding, eventually some 27 states enacted similar forced sterilization laws, and some 65,000 Americans were prevented against their will from reproducing. The progressive roots of Nazism. I cannot conclude this chapter without pointing out that three of the schemes of the progressive plantation, race-based immigration restriction, racial segregation, and forced sterilization, provided models for the Nazi Party in the early 1930s. Hitler himself praised progressive immigration restrictions in America, noting that by simply excluding certain races from naturalization, they displayed, in slow beginnings, Hitler's own move toward the Nazi idea of a racially supremacist state. Hitler also praised anti-miscegenation laws championed by American progressives. The Germanic inhabitant of the American continent, he wrote in Mein Kampf, who has remained racially pure and unmixed, rose to be master of the continent. He will remain the master as long as he does not fall victim to the defilement of the blood. James Whitman shows in Hitler's American model that the Nazis explicitly modeled their Nuremberg laws, laws that segregated Jews into ghettos, prevented them from intermarrying with other Germans, and excluded them from citizenship, on the Jim Crow laws of the Democratic South. Whitman's documentation is thorough. He even has the records of the Nuremberg meetings showing how the Nazis basically took the democratic laws, crossed out the word black, wrote in the word Jew, and had their work largely done for them. In the crushing words of Roland Freisler, state secretary of the Nazi Ministry of Justice, surveying the democratic segregation and state-sponsored discrimination laws, "This jurisprudence would suit us perfectly." Here was the actual scene. A senior group of Nazis is gathered around a table with a stenographer present to record what one of them termed an historic occasion. They were in the process of founding the world's first racist state. Then one of the Nazis, Heinrich Krieger, who studied in the United States, sheepishly raised his hand and informed his colleagues that they could not do this because the Democratic Party in the United States had beaten them to it. The Nazis were incredulous, but Krieger was right. The Nazis wanted to segregate Jews into ghettos, and the Southern Democrats had already done this. The Nazis wanted to prevent intermarriage between Jews and other Germans. This mirrored what miscegenation laws, passed mostly by Democrats, did in many American states. Finally, the Nazis wanted state-sponsored discrimination that would permit confiscation of Jewish property. Precisely this type of state-sponsored discrimination was the norm throughout the Democratic South. So the Nazis reviewed the democratic laws of the Jim Crow South and framed their Nuremberg laws specifically on them. In doing so, the Nazis knew full well they were adapting the policies of the Democrats. Yet tellingly, there is no textbook in the United States, to my knowledge, that describes this Nazi-democratic connection. Never once has CNN or NPR or the History Channel documented the role of the Democratic Party in shaping Nazi racism. Whitman, a progressive legal scholar, is also reluctant to assign blame where it is due. He talks about American white supremacy, American racism, American law, and American influence on the Nuremberg laws. Surely he knows that the democratic laws were bitterly contested under the nation's two-party system. Yes, there were anti-miscegenation laws in a couple of Republican states, but America in general didn't do this. The Democrats did. Yet, as the very title of Whitman's book suggests, he resorts to the familiar tactic of blaming America, not the Democratic Party, for inspiring Nazi policies. Much in the same vein, the German historian Stefan Kuhl, whom I interviewed in Munich, shows in the Nazi connection that Hitler's forced sterilization policies of 1933 were lifted almost verbatim from blueprints supplied earlier in the century by American progressive eugenicists. Under the Nazis, forced sterilization gave way to compulsory euthanasia for the sick and disabled. And later, those same killing facilities were expanded into the gas chambers that were used for Hitler's final solution. Did American progressives know that they had shaped Hitler's policies? Kuhl shows that they certainly did. In fact, they understood Nazi policies as the direct realization of their scientific goals and political demands. In 1934, Leon Whitney, secretary of the American Eugenics Society, confessed that American progressive eugenicists have long been working earnestly towards something very like what Hitler has now made compulsory. Kuhl reports that Clarence Campbell, another close associate of Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger, attended the 1935 International Population Congress in Berlin, where he raised a toast to that great leader, Adolf Hitler. Sanger herself gave speeches in the mid-1930s praising the Nazi sterilization laws and recommending that America move faster in this direction to keep up with what Hitler had done. A progressive himself, Kuhl knows how damning it is to trace Nazi sterilization and mass murder to the inspiration of American progressives. Thus, to spread the blame around, he insists that the responsibility for these atrocities falls equally on the left and on the right. Kuhl declares it ironic that a progressive Democrat like Woodrow Wilson and an avowed socialist like Margaret Sanger inspired the right-wing Nazis. But there is no irony involved because, as I'll show in the next chapter, the Nazis were themselves left-wing socialists with an ideological agenda closely parallel to that of their American progressive counterparts. In the end, Wilson's progressive plantation, the centralized state, remained an incomplete project. The conditions weren't right, and Wilson himself was too much of a pointy-headed intellectual to get it done. The distinctive racist elements of Wilson's plantation, racial terrorism, federal segregation, and eugenic sterilization, would eventually become a progressive embarrassment. Yet they would be retained and modified in more palatable form in the Democratic plantation scheme as it evolved in the 1930s and beyond. It would require more propitious circumstances, ideally a major crisis of some sort, to make that plantation scheme a reality. It would take another Democrat with the same tyrannical impulse as Wilson, but less educated and more cunning to get the job done. Such a man would have to be a creative improviser of the Van Buren type, but even more unscrupulous, a mafia boss, unhampered by conscience. Only such a man could achieve the practical realization of the progressive plantation. In New York, there was such a man. Chapter 7. The State as Big House. What FDR Learned from Fascism and Nazism. If fascism ever comes to America, it will be in the name of liberalism. Ronald Reagan. 60 Minutes Interview, 1975. In 1935, Sinclair Lewis published a novel, It Can't Happen Here, which envisioned the coming to power of a fascist regime in the United States. Little did Lewis, progressive leftist and former socialist, know that even while he was writing the book, the administration of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was consciously importing fascist ideas to America. Lewis, of course, knew that American fascism would not be identical with Italian or German fascism. It would not feature swastikas or Deutschland über alles. It would be built on homegrown symbols and take on a uniquely American character. Even so, Lewis completely missed what was happening in front of him because he could not see the fascist elements on his own ideological side. This chapter is about FDR and the fascist plantation. In it, I will show that during the 1920s and 30s, the Italian fascists under Mussolini and the German fascists under Hitler developed a new type of plantation governed by the all-powerful centralized state. FDR then imported that fascist model to America, modifying it into a shape that was distinctively American. FDR created what we may call democratic fascism, fascism that could win popular support and sustain the president in office for four terms. In the process, FDR permanently transformed the Democratic Party and remade the Democratic plantation. FDR's fascist plantation is not merely recognizable in its key elements, it also supplies the basic operational template for today's Democratic Party. I recognize that for many people, the very notion of a fascist plantation will come as a surprise. Fascism is a European ideology. What does it have to do with the plantation system of American slavery? An even bigger surprise is the notion that an American president, indeed the leading progressive figure of his time, was actually influenced by fascism, let alone that he emulated the fascist leaders that he is famous for fighting and defeating in World War II. Some progressive Democrats won't just take issue, they will take umbrage at my attempt to link FDR with the fascist and Nazi horrors of the 20th century. Hitler, however, was quite familiar with the slave plantation. The progressive historian Ira Katznelson writes, "Hitler denigrated blacks, admired American racism, and regretted the South's defeat in 1865. Hitler also hated Lincoln and blamed him for how the beginnings of a great new social order based on the principle of slavery and inequality were destroyed by the war." Many scholars have noted the similarities between Nazi concentration camps and slave camps of the Democratic South. I grant that it seems wrong-headed, even obscene, to compare death camps where millions died to democratic slave plantations. The former existed for the purpose of extermination, the latter for forced labor. The two are not morally equivalent. I agree, and I'm not making such a comparison. The perception that I am rests on a failure to distinguish between Nazi concentration camps and Nazi death camps. From Dachau to Mauthausen to Ravensbrück, there were hundreds of concentration camps throughout Germany and in German-occupied territories. By contrast, there were just a few death camps: Auschwitz, Belzec, Chelmno, Treblinka, Majdanek, and